on our screen. Some hard, skittering animal in the bed grazes at her wrist. She startles and shouts, her husband's movable hand knocking against hers. It's deliberate, the screen says. This must be deliberate. She takes his stiff, curled fingers and grips them. They stare together, understanding nothing. Orange, white, gray, and black billow against a cloudless blue. The towers vent like cracks in the crust of the earth. They waver, then drop. The screen staggers. People in the streets scatter and scream. One of the towers folds up flat like collapsible hanging shelves. The animal shrieking will not stop. Refusal trickles from Ray's mouth. She has seen this before. Monstrous columns, too big to be felled, falling. She thinks, finally, the whole strange dream of safety, of separation, will die. But when it comes to prediction, she has always been worse than wrong. Hyde Street, in Nob Hill, on a block lined with camouflaged California sycamores, and one crooked Asian plum that bursts out in cream craziness for 3 weeks each spring. Mimi Ma sits in her shade-drawn first-floor office, preparing for her second and final client of the day. The first lasted 3 hours. It was his contractual right to stay however long he needed, but the session polished her down to a blunted nib. The second one will suck the day's remaining life from her. She'll retreat to her apartment in the Castro tonight to watch nature documentaries and listen to trance music, then sleep and rise to face 2 more clients tomorrow. Unconventional therapists flood this city. Counselors, analysts, spirit guides, self-actualizing assistants, personal consultants, and borderline charlatans, many as surprised as Mimi to find themselves in the trade. But her reputation has spread so well by word of mouth that she can afford the office's absurd rent while seeing only 2 clients a day. The real question, session by session, is whether she can stay sane herself as her clients eat her soul. Many of her prospective patrons suffer from nothing worse than too much money. She tells them so at the screening interviews every other Friday. She won't see anyone who isn't in pain, and she can tell how much pain a person is in within 20 seconds of their sitting in the wing chair that faces hers in her bare session room. She talks to each applicant for a few minutes, not about their psyches, but about the weather, sports, or childhood pets. Then she'll either schedule a session or send the seeker home, saying, "You don't need me. You just need to see that you're already happy." For that advice, she charges nothing. But for a real session, there must be some sacrifice. 2 such sacrifices a day suffice to keep her afloat. She sits to the right of the bricked-up fireplace, recovering. In the anteroom of 50, she's still slim, from the distance running she has taken up, although the cowl of black hair has chestnut highlights now, still marked by the scar across one cheek that has never vanished. Her hand strokes her steel-gray jeans and travels the pleats of her cyan blouse, the one that makes her feel a little like a troubadour. Her office manager has called the next client to say that the therapist is free. There's just enough time to climb up out of the morning's 4-hour cauldron of fear, grief, hope, and transfiguration shared with a total stranger before plunging back into it with another. She bathes her mind in Zen aimlessness. She picks up one of the framed photos from the mantelpiece, the one of an elderly Chinese couple holding up a photo of 3 little girls. It's a studio shot in front of a backdrop. The man wears an expensive linen suit, and the woman a silk dress tailored in Shanghai before the war. The couple gaze sadly at the photo of their American granddaughters with the inscrutable names. They'll never meet these foreign girls, or their mother, that fallen Virginia Scion, who will die in a facility after forgetting what species she is. And their wandering son. It's like the couple already knows, as the lens opens, at this precise moment, years before the violent crime. How does a man rise or fall in this life? The fisherman's song flows deep under the river. Once there was a little girl, bristly, a bully even, trying to preserve herself across a great divide. Not yellow, not white, not anything Wheaton had ever seen. Only that fisherman ever knew her, motionless by her side on long, slow days in untamed places, when they both stared and cast into the same running stream. She feels it again, worse for the unthinkable time and distance. Rage at his leaving. Then rage at the world for cutting down the harmless grove where his ghost liked to walk, where she liked to sit and ask him why, where she once almost even got an answer. A chime shatters Mimi's reverie. Stephanie N., her afternoon guest, arrives in the front office. Mimi returns the photo and presses a button on the underside of the mantel, telling Catherine that she's ready. A soft knock on the door, and Mimi rises to greet an ample, wiry-haired redhead with tortoiseshell glasses. The hunter-green tunic and its half-cape fail to hide her paunch. It doesn't take a rabid empath to feel the visitor's broken mainspring. Mimi smiles and touches Stephanie's shoulder. Relax. There's nothing to worry about. Stephanie's eyes widen. There isn't? Hold still. Let me have a look while you're standing. You've gone to the bathroom? You've eaten? You left your cell phone, watch, and all other devices with Catherine? Not carrying anything? No makeup or jewelry? Stephanie is clean on all counts. Good. Please sit. The visitor takes the proffered chair, unsure how this can lead to the magic that her brother-in-law called the most bruising, profound experience of his adult life. Wouldn't it help to know a little about me? Mimi cocks her head and smiles. There are so many names for the thing that everyone is scared to death of, and everyone wants to tell you theirs. Stephanie? By the time we're done, we're going to know more about each other than there are words for. Stephanie daubs at her eyes, nods, laughs two syllables, then flicks her fingers. Ready. 4 minutes in, Mimi stops the session. She leans in and touches Stephanie's knee. Listen. Just look at me. That's all you need to do. Stephanie palms an apology and reels her hand back into her lips. I know. I'm sorry. If you're self-conscious, if you're afraid, don't worry. It doesn't matter. Just keep your eyes on mine. Stephanie bows her head. She sits up and they try again. It happens often, this false start. No one suspects how hard it is to hold another's gaze for more than 3 seconds. A quarter minute, and they're in agony. Introverts and extroverts, dominants and submissives alike. Scopophobia hits them all. Fear of seeing and being seen. A dog will bite if you stare at it too hard. People will shoot you. And though she has looked for hours into the eyes of hundreds of people, though she has perfected the art of endurance staring, Mimi feels a tinge of fear herself, even now, gazing into the skittering eyes of Stephanie, who, blushing a little, powers through the shame and settles down. The women lock in, awkward and naked. A tick at the corner of Stephanie's lips makes Mimi smile back.
Sheesh,
the client's eyes say. Yes, the therapist agrees. Humiliating. The awkwardness turns pleasant enough. Stephanie, the likable. Stephanie, the good-natured, the mostly self-assured. I'm a decent person, see? It doesn't matter. Stephanie's lower lid tightens, and her orbicularis oculi twitches. Do I make sense to you? Am I much like everyone else? Why do I feel like I'm falling through the cracks of social goodwill? Mimi squints less than the width of two lashes. Microscopic reprimand. Just look. Just look. 5 minutes in, Stephanie's breathing shifts and narrows. Okay, I see. I'm getting this. You haven't even started. Mimi watches the woman come into focus. A mother, and of more than one. Cannot stop taking care of the therapist. Wife of a man who, after a dozen years, has become civil and distant. A bear in his lair. Sex is perfunctory maintenance at best. But you're mistaken, the speculating therapist tells herself. You know nothing. And the thought registers across the minute muscles of her face. Just look. Looking must correct and heal all thoughts. At 10 minutes, Stephanie fidgets. When does the magic start to happen? Mimi's eyes bear down. Even in this tedium, Stephanie's pulse rises. She sits forward. Her nostrils flare. Then everything relaxes from scalp to ankles. Well, here goes. What you see is what you get. What I get is beyond your control. The weird shit in this room, I'd better not leave it. Safer than Vegas. I'm not sure what I'm doing here.
Me neither.
I'm not sure I'd like you if I met you at a party.
I don't always like myself. At parties, almost never.
This can't possibly be worth what I'm paying, even if I stay all afternoon.
What is it worth to be looked at without judgment for as long as you need?
Who am I kidding? It's my husband's money.
I'm living off my father's inheritance, which might have been stolen.
I've let men define me.
I'm really an engineer. I'm only pretending to be a therapist.
Help me. I wake up at 3 in the morning with a black thing clawing my chest.
My name isn't really Judith Hansen. I changed it from Mimi Ma.
On Sundays when the sun goes down, I don't want to live.
Sunday evenings save me. Just knowing that in a few hours I'll be working again.
Is it the towers? I think it might be the towers. I've been so brittle, like frozen glass.
Towers are always falling.
A quarter hour passes. Unrelenting human scrutiny. The weirdest trip Stephanie has ever been on. 15 endless minutes of staring at a woman she doesn't know from Eve triggers things. Things she hasn't thought about in decades. She looks at Mimi and sees a crow's-footed, scar-faced Asian version of her high school girlfriend, a girl she broke with at 19 over some imagined slight. There's no one to apologize to now except this stranger who won't stop staring at her. Time passes. A lifetime. A few more seconds. In a room with nothing to look at but a stranger's damaged face. The trap closes around Stephanie, her eyes cloud with resentment bordering on hate. A tremor of Mimi's lips sends Stephanie back to that day 3 years ago when she at last faced down her mother and called her a bitch. And her mother's mouth in that instant. Stephanie squeezes her eyes shut, rules of this game be damned, and when she opens again, she sees her mother 8 more months down the line of panic, on a respirator in the hospital, dying of COPD, fighting to keep all thought of that day's accusation out of her face as her daughter leans in to kiss her stony forehead. The watch that Stephanie left in the reception room ticks on, out of sight and hearing. Away from it, far from all claims on her, the visitor remembers herself, soft, sad, out of nowhere, at the age of 6, wanting to be a nurse. Toy props, syringe, blood pressure cuff, white hat, picture books and dolls. 3 years of obsession, followed by 35 of amnesia, retrieved only by going down the rabbit hole of another woman's eyes. Nothing else exists outside this pact. Pupils lock and can't look away. The years parade through Stephanie's mind. Childhood, youth, adolescence, the immunity of young adulthood, followed by endless scared maturity. She's naked now, in front of someone she has agreed never to try to see again after today. Through the two-way mirror, Mimi sees. Such pain you're in. Here, too. How can it be? In a patch of sun that falls between them, a green feeling opens to the light. Mimi lets it play across her face, there for the seeing. Therapy. You remind me of my sisters. She lets this woman in, up into the breakfast tree, backyard, Wheaton, Illinois, where she, Carmen, and Amelia have already taken their cereal bowls up onto the summer limbs and are busy reading each other's futures in the floating oat rings. That Virginia missionary's daughter stands at the kitchen window, the one who'll die of dementia in a nursing home without ever having looked her daughters in the eye for more than half a second. That Hue man coming from the house to call to his daughters, "My silk farm, what you do?" The mulberry, sweet, crooked and open, rounded with shade, dripping peace, lying about everything the future would hold. A great sororal surge comes over Stephanie. She reaches her hand to this slight half-Asian shaman 4 feet from her. One quick tightening of Mimi's corrugator muscles warns her off. There's more. So much more. At half an hour, Stephanie melts down. She's hungry, stiff, itchy, and so sick of herself she wants to sleep forever. The truth seeps out of her, a bodily discharge. You shouldn't trust me. I don't deserve this. You see, I'm fucked up in ways even my children don't suspect. I stole from my brother. I left the scene of an accident. I've had sex with men whose names I don't even know. Several times. Recently. Yes. Hush. I'm wanted in 3 states. Their faces feed pitiless into one another. Muscles move, the world's slowest flipbook. Terror, shame, desperation, hope. Each lasts its own 3-second lifetime. After an hour, the islands of emotion wash into an open sea. The two faces swell. Their mouths and noses and brows expand to fill a Rushmore. Truth hovers between them. Great and nebulous, a thing their bodies keep them from reaching. Another hour. Deserts of infinite boredom, punctuated by peaks of freakish intensity. More annihilated memories percolate up from below, so many moments recovered and lost again in this loop of looking. Hydra-like multiplying memories, longer than the lives that made them. Stephanie sees. So clear now. She's an animal, a mere avatar. The other woman, too. Stuff-imprisoned spirit, deluded into thinking it's autonomous. And yet, conjoined, linked to each other, a pair of local gods who have lived and felt all things. One of them has a thought, which at once becomes the other's. Enlightenment is a shared enterprise. It needs some other voice saying, "You are not wrong." If only I could remember this in real time, under fire, I'd be cured.
There are no cures.
Is this it? Is there more? Maybe I should go.
No.
In hour three, truths flow loose and terrible. Things come out of hiding that would lose them membership in any club but this one that they can't quit. I've lied to my closest friends.
Yes, I let my mother die unattended.
I spied on my husband and read his private letters.
Yes, I cleaned bits of my father's brain off the backyard flagstones.
My son won't talk to me. He says I ruined his life.
Yes, I helped kill my friend.
How can you bear to look at me?
There are harder things to bear.
The sunlight changes. Slits of light crawl up the walls. It occurs to Stephanie to wonder if it's still today, or if that was some time ago. Her pupils have long since started to seesaw, closing and dilating by turns, dimming and glaring the room. She can't even summon up the will to stand and leave. When it can't go on, that's when this will end. Then they'll never see each other again. Except for always. Her eyes burn. She blinks, numb, dumb, ravenous, wrecked, and badly in need of emptying her bladder. Something keeps her from breathing. This frail, scarred woman who won't look away. Pinned in that look, she becomes something else, huge and fixed, swaying in the wind and pelted by rain. The whole urgent calculus of need, what she called her life, shrinks down to a pore on the underside of a leaf, way out on the tip of a wind-dipped branch, high up in the crown of a community too big for any glance to take in. And way down below, subterranean, in the humus, through the roots of humility, gifts flow. Her cheeks tense up. She wants to shout, "Who are you? Why won't you stop? No one has ever looked at me like this except to judge, rob, or rape me. In my whole life, never." Her face reddens. With slow, heavy, disbelieving swings of her head, she starts to cry. The tears do whatever they want. Call it sobbing. The therapist is crying, too. "Why? Why am I sick? What's wrong with me?"
"Loneliness. But not for people. You're mourning a thing you never even knew."
"What thing?"
"A great, spoked, wild, woven-together place beyond replacing. One you didn't even know was yours to lose."
"Where did it go?"
"Into making us. But it still wants something."
Stephanie is up and out of the chair, clinging to the stranger, taking her by the shoulders, nodding, crying, nodding. And the stranger lets her. Of course. Grief. Grief for a thing too big to see. Mimi pulls back to ask if Stephanie is all right. All right to leave. All right to drive. But Stephanie puts fingers on her mouth and hushes the therapist forever. The changed woman makes it out onto Hyde Street. Two facade painters up on a scaffold yell at each other over a blaring radio. Men with dollies unload stacks of boxes from a delivery truck 6 doors up the street. A guy in a dirty suit jacket and shorts, his hair bound up in a bungee cord, cuts behind her on the sidewalk, talking out loud. Voices or cell phone? Choose your schizophrenia. Stephanie steps into the street, and a car screams past. The rage of its horn dopplers downward for another block. She fights to hold on to the thing she has just glimpsed. But traffic, bickering, business, The street's brutality begins to close in. She walks faster, on the brink of the old panic. Everything she has just won begins to fade again into the irresistible force of other people. Something sharp grazes her face. She stops and touches her scraped cheek. The culprit floats in front of her. Purple-pink, the colors of a 5-year-old's crazed sketch. Escaping from a metal cage in the sidewalk near her feet is a thing twice her height and half again as wide as her extended arms. A single, stout, upward path splits into a few thinner ones, and those divide into thousands more, thinner still, each one tentative, forked, full of scars, bent by history, and tipped out in insane flowers. The sight takes root in her, ramifying, and for a moment longer she remembers. Her life has been as wild as a plum in spring. Just down the road, 2,000 miles east, Nicholas Hole drives into an Iowa June. Every dimple in the land, every remembered silo just off the interstate, twists his gut, like the last thing he sees before dying. Like coming home. The math stuns him. How few years he has been away. So much has gone untouched. The farms, the roadside warehouses, the desperate public service billboards. For God so loved the world. So many imprints from deepest childhood, permanent scars in the prairie and in him. Yet every landmark seems warped and remote, seen through dime store binoculars. Nothing here should have survived where he's been. Over the last rise to the west, before the exit, his pulse shoots up. He looks for the horizon's lone mast. But where the column of the whole chestnut should be, there's only June's annihilating blue. He heads the car up the exit ramp and drives the long square back around to the farm. Only it's not a farm anymore. It's a manufactory. The owners have removed the tree. He parks the car halfway up the gravel drive and walks out across the field toward the stump, forgetting that the field is no longer his to walk across. 150 steps in, he sees the green. Dozens of fresh chestnut shoots spring up from the dead stump. He sees the leaves, the straight-veined, toothed lances of his childhood that always meant leaf to him. For a few heartbeats, resurrection. Then he remembers. These fresh starts, too, will soon be blighted. They'll die and rise again over and over, just often enough to keep the deadly blight alive and vigorous. He turns toward the ancestral house. His hands lift to reassure anyone in the parlor who might be watching. But it's the house, in fact, and not the tree that has stopped living. Siding pulls away from the walls. On the north side, half a length of gutter hangs down. He checks his watch. 6:05, obligatory dinner hour throughout the Midwest. He crosses the weedy lawn and walks up to the east windows. They're matte, dusty, lusterless, dimmed with only dark behind them. The stiles, rails, head jamb, and all the wood around the double-hung panes soften into paint-peeled rot. Cupping one hand around his eyes, Nicholas peeks in. His grandparents' living room is filled with metal basins and canisters. The oak trim that covered every doorway in the house has been stripped away. He walks around to the front porch. Its planks wobble beneath him. 5 raps of the brass knocker yield nothing. He climbs the rise behind the house to the old outbuildings. 1 has been torn down. 1 is gutted. 3 is locked. His old trompe-l'œil mural, that crack in the wall of the cornfield revealing a hidden broadleaf forest, is gunmetal gray. On the front porch again, he sits where the rocker used to be, his back to the front window. It's not clear how he should proceed. It crosses his mind to break in. He has spent the last 3 nights sleeping rough, scared shitless by a cow near the Bighorns in Wyoming, who nuzzled him in his bag before dawn. Kept awake in a national forest in Nebraska by 2 campers setting endurance records in a nearby tent. A bed would be nice. A shower. But the house, it seems, has neither anymore. He waits for the softening smudge of Midwestern dusk, though there's no real need for cover. Far away, a satellite-guided agribiz monster, practically robotic, combs through the rolling fields. No one will pass here or see him at his task. He can do what he needs to and go. But he waits. Waiting has become his religion. There's corn to listen to, miles of it, beans to watch grow, sheds and silos on the horizon, an interstate, and a huge tree cut out of the sky in negative space, like a Magritte. He sits with his back against the house, feeling the farm emerge again, like wild animals from the edges of a trail when the hiker holds still long enough. As the clouds crimson out, he heads to the car and retrieves his folding campfire shovel. Wrong tool for the wrong job, but the best he has. In a minute, he's on the rise behind the machine shed, looking for loose gravel. The ground feels different. The distances are wrong. Even the machine shed has been moved. The scree turns up, hiding under a lush green shag. He snicks the campfire shovel into the weeds and digs until he hits the past. Return of the repressed. He hauls up the carton and opens it. Panels and some works on paper. He holds the top painting to the day's last light. A man lies in bed, staring down the tip of a large branch that comes growing in through his window. That's how it happened. He was sleeping, and she burst in. Each of them had half a prophecy. They put them together and read the message. They found their joint calling, their shared vocation. The spirits guaranteed that all would be well. Now, she's dead. He's sleepwalking again, and the things they were to save are all going down. He sets the carton down beside the hole and digs again. The second box surfaces, filled with paintings he forgot he made. Family tree, shoe tree, money tree. Barking up the wrong tree. All painted in the years before she came up the driveway with stories of resurrection and voices of light. The paintings proved that they were meant to head off together. The paintings were wrong. He stacks the second box on top of the first and keeps digging. The shovel tip hits something jagged, and he finds the sculpture load. He and Olivia buried 4 of them loose to see what the living soil might do to the ceramic skins. Dirt, another thing she taught him to see, a new inch or two every few centuries, a microscopic forest, 100,000 species in a few Iowa grams. He drops to his knees, pries out the pieces with his fingers, and wipes them with a spit-dampened handkerchief. Their monochrome surfaces now shine as rich-hued as Bruegel's. Bacteria, fungi, invertebrates, living workshops down in the underground horizons have spattered patinas across the sculptures in a masterpiece of blooms. He sets the transmuted statues on top of the rescued boxes and returns for the real prize. He wonders again what he could have been thinking, leaving it here. Travel light, they thought. Bury the art. Digging it up later would be its own performance piece. But the thing still in the ground is worth more than his own life, and he should never have let it out of his sight. 6 more shovelfuls, and it's his again. He opens the box, unzips the bag, and holds the 100-year stack of photos in his hands. Too dark to see now, to flip through them. He doesn't need to. Holding the stack, he feels the tree spiraling up into the air like a corkscrew fountain, watched over by generations of holes. He carries half of the trove down the rise, back to his car. He gets the loot into the trunk and turns back for the rest. Halfway to the burial site, two white lights pierce the gravel driveway from the dark road. Police. The thing to do is walk toward the squad car with open palms. Every explanation can be documented. The evidence will support his story. Trespassing, yes, but only to retrieve what's his. He comes out from behind the house, and the headlights veer toward him. It occurs to him that the buried treasure in question might not, in fact, be his any longer. He sold the land and everything rooted in it. Buying and selling land. As absurd as getting arrested for recovering your own art. The squad car jerks up the drive, its wheels spewing gravel. A blast of spinning red stops Nicholas in place. The car swings to a stop, flaring into a barricade. Siren whoop gives way to an amplified voice.
Freeze! Down on the ground!
He can't do both. He raises his hands and drops to his knees. Travels back 40 years to a grade school skit. The rain came down and washed the spider out. Two officers are on him in a heartbeat. Only then does it strike Nicholas that he's in real trouble. If they fingerprint him, if they run his record...
Hands out!
One of the officers presses into Nick's back and draws his wrists together. Once he's cuffed, they sit him up on the ground, shine a flashlight in his face, and take his data.
It's trinkets, he tells them.
Worthless.
Their faces curl when he shows them his art. Why would someone want to make such things, let alone steal them back? The only part of the story that makes sense to them is the burying. But the older cop recognizes the name on Nick's driver's license. Part of local history. Landmark for the whole area.
Keep going, a mile, mile and a half, past the whole tree.
They call the business manager in charge of the property. The man has zero interest in bits of dug-up rubbish. Rural Iowa, the police don't look up his arrests in the national database. He's just another semi-delusional, semi-vagrant from a ruined farm family, driving a dinged-up car and trying to hold on to a vanished past.
You can go now, the police tell him. No more digging on private property.
Can I just... Nick waves his hand toward the unburied treasure. The officers shrug.
Knock yourself out.
They watch as Nick puts the last cartons in his car. He turns to them. Have you ever seen a tree grow 80 years in 10 seconds?
You take care now, says the cop who pinned him to the ground.
Then they send the 3-time arsonist on his way. Nile sits at the head of the oval table facing his top 5 project managers. He spreads his bony fingers on the table in front of him. He doesn't know where to start. It's even hard to know how to address the game. There are no version numbers anymore. They've been replaced by continuous upgrades. Mastery Online is now a mammoth, expanding, ever-evolving enterprise. But it's rotten at its core.
We have a Midas problem. There's no end game, just a stagnant, pyramiding scheme. Endless, pointless prosperity.
The team listens, frowning. They all earn 6 figures. Most are millionaires. The youngest is 28, the oldest 42. But in their jeans and skateboard tees, their mop tops and skewed baseball caps, they look like simulated teens. Bohm and Robinson kick back, sipping energy drinks and munching trail bars. Nguyen has his feet up on the table
and gazes through the window as if it's a virtual reality headset. All five beep and ding, whistle and vibrate, with more prosthetic parts than sci-fi ever dreamed of. How do you win? I mean, how would you even lose? The only thing that really counts is hoarding a little bit more. You reach a certain level in the game, and going on just feels hollow, dirty, more of the same. The man in the wheelchair at the table's head bows and stares into his own grave. The long Sikh-style hair still flows down around his middle, but it's shot through now with a river of white. A beard erupts from his chin and falls like a bib onto his Superman sweatshirt. His arms still have some meat on them, from decades of lifting himself in and out of bed, but his legs, inside their cargo pants, are a little more than vague suggestions. In front of him, on the table, is a book. The elves know what that means. The boss has been reading again. Another visionary idea has taken possession of him. Soon he'll badger them all to read it, in search of solutions to what is a problem only to him. Kaltoff, Rasha, Robinson, Nguyen, Bohm. Five ebullient honors students huddle up in a super-smart war room, equipped with banks of screens and all the electronic conferencing toys tomorrow might need. But today, they can only stare at the boss, slack-jawed. He's saying mastery is broken. A magic, money-printing franchise needs to be rethought. Exasperation threatens to set Kaltoff's mustache on fire. It's a god game, for God's sake! They pay us so they can enjoy a god's problems. We're up to 7 million subscribers, Rasha says. A quarter of them have been playing for a decade. Players are hiring Chinese inmates with web connections to level up their characters while they sleep. The boss does that thing with his eyebrows. If leveling was still fun, they wouldn't have to do that. There might be a problem, Robinson concedes, but it's the same problem we've been dealing with since mastery began. Nile's head bobs up and down, but not in a nod. I wouldn't say dealing. Postponing, maybe. He's grown so gaunt he's set for sainthood. The lip of the sagging Superman sweatshirt reveals his protruding collarbone. He's like one of those ascetic Indian statues, a skin-wrapped skeleton seated under a holy fig or neem. Bohm projects some visuals. Here's what we're thinking. We raise the experience level caps again. We add a bunch of technologies. We call them Future Tech 1, Future Tech 2. They all generate different flavors of prestige points. Then we release another volcanic event out in the middle of the Western Ocean and start a new continent. That sounds like postponing to me. Kaltoff flings up his hands. People want to grow, expand their empires. That's why they pay us every month. The place fills in, we make it a little bigger. There's no other way to run a world. I see. Lather, rinse, repeat until you die of consummation. Kaltoff slaps the table. Robinson laughs, giddy. Rasha thinks, it's just the boss, the guy who writes a million memos a week, the guy who built the company from nothing, exercising his genius right to be wrong. Which is more interesting, Nile asks. 200 million square miles filled with 100 kinds of biome and 9 million species of living things? Or a handful of flashing colored pixels on a 2D screen? Nervous laughter around the table. They get which should make the better home, but each one knows his own delight's current mailing address. Pretty clear where the species is emigrating, boss. Why? Why give up an endlessly rich place to live in a cartoon map? It's a little too much philosophy for the boy millionaires.
But they humor the man who hired them all. They loosen into the question, listing the glories of symbol space, the cleanness, the speed, the instant feedback, the power and control, the connectivity, the sheer amount of stuff you can amass, the buffs and badges, all the compliant pleasures that light up the whole cortex. They talk about the purity of the game, how it's always going somewhere at a clip that's clearly visible. You can see progress unfold. Effort means something. Nile nods his refusal again. Until it doesn't. Until it turns tedious. The group falls silent. Mass sobriety sets in. Nguyen takes his feet off the table. People want a better story than they get. The wild-haired Sadhu leans forward so fast he almost pitches out of his wheelchair. Yes! And what do all good stories do? There are no takers. Nile holds up his arms and extends his palms in the oddest gesture. In another moment, leaves will grow from his fingers. Birds will come and nest in them. They kill you a little. They turn you into something you weren't. Awareness spreads through them, slow and certain as death. The boss is playing another game now, one that would have no trouble burning their game as fuel. Bohm asks, "What are you saying we should do?" Nile holds up the book like it's divine dictation. They can read the title on the cover, under the rising web of leaves. The Secret Forest. Robinson groans. Not more plants, boss. You can't make a game out of plants unless you give them bazookas. Let's put an atmosphere into the model. Add water quality, nutrient cycles, finite material resources. Let's make prairies and wetlands and forests that capture the richness and complexity of the real deals. And then what? Bleaching reefs and rising seas and drought-driven wildfires? If that's how people play it. Why on earth? Our players want to get away from all that shit. The game wants its players. That's the great mystery. How would you win that? Kaltoff taunts. By finding out what works. By pushing the way truth pushes. You're saying no new continents. No new continents. No sudden spawning of new mineral deposits. Regeneration only at realistic rates. No rising from the grave. A wrong choice in the game should lead to permadeath. The elves catch each other's eyes. The boss is out of control. He's willing to crash the franchise, to trash the endless moneymaker that will keep them all in junkets forever, just to solve the problem of too much satisfaction. How, Nguyen says, how are limits and shortages and permadeath going to be fun? For a moment, the sunken face turns rubbery, and the boss is a little kid again, learning how to program, his code branching outward in all directions. 7 million users will need to discover the rules of a dangerous new place. To learn what the world will bear, how life really works, what it wants from a player in exchange for continuing to play. Now that's a game. A whole new age of exploration. What more adventure could you ask for? Kaltoff says, Better sell your Semper Virens stock then, because every player we have is going to quit. They'll walk. Walk where? There's too much on the line. Most of our players have invested years. They've built up fortunes of in-game worth. They'll figure out how to rehabilitate the place. They'll surprise us. Like they've always done. The elves sit dumbfounded, calculating the fortunes vanishing before their eyes. But the boss is glowing like he hasn't since he fell from his childhood tree. He lifts the book in the air, opens it, and reads, Something marvelous is happening underground. Something we're just starting to learn how to see.
He snaps the book shut for dramatic effect.
There's nothing out there even remotely like it. We'd be the first. Imagine, a game with the goal of growing the world instead of yourself.
The silence thickens with the proposed madness. Kaltoff says,
Not broke, boss. Don't fix. I vote no.
The skeletal saint goes around the table one by one. Russia? Nguyen? Robinson? Bohm? No,
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 and no.
Unanimous palace coup. Nile feels nothing, not even surprise. Semper Virens, with its 5 divisions and countless employees, its massive annual revenues from subscriptions and media, hasn't been under anyone's control for some time. The tens of thousands of fans, posting to online forums, have more control over what happens next than any of the upper brass. Complex adaptive system. A god game that has escaped its god. It's clear to him. The massively parallel online experience will go on, faithful to the tyranny of the place it pretends to escape. And the 63rd richest man in Santa Clara County, founder of Semper Virens, Inc., creator of the Sylvan Prophecies, only child, devotee of distant worlds, lover of Hindi comics, avid fan of all rule-breaking stories, flyer of digital kites, timid cursor of teachers, faller from Coast Live Oaks, learns what it means to be eaten alive by his own insatiable offspring.
It's ancient history now, a decade-old story Douglas Pavlicek keeps in his arsenal to spring on unsuspecting summer visitors who wander into the erstwhile whorehouse that serves as the ghost town visitor center. He'll lay it on anyone who holds still long enough to hear. Then I had to crab walk backward, uphill, on my ass, kicking off from tree trunks with my good leg, switchbacked up an 80-foot bluff in the snow, while my dislocated shoulders stabbed me like the Holy Ghost with a hot poker, crawled in and out of consciousness as far as that old silver mine head frame not 100 yards from here, and there I lay, as good as dead for who knows how long. Seeing visions and hearing the forest talk, while wolverines and such probably licked my face for the salts on my skin. By miracle, I reached the office, called in the medevacs, and got a lift to Missoula in a chopper. Felt like I was back in Nam, about to shoot out of my old herky bird and start the whole wheel of eternal return over again.
He tells the story a lot, and the tourists mostly put up with it. Then, one evening, 10 minutes after quitting time, he tells it to a woman across the display case who digs it. Youngish, kind of, in bandana and backpack, with a cute-as-hell Eastern European accent, a little ripe-scented, but friendly as a retriever covered with ticks. She's all on the balls of her feet, waiting to hear if he survives or not. Deep into the rising action, he starts improvising a little. Let's face it, there's only so much that the arc of his story will hold.
Yet she's eating it up, like he's one of those epileptic Russian novelists, and all she wants is to find out what happens next, and next after that.
When the story ends, she watches him close up the office. Outside, in the lot, there's nothing but his white BLM Ford anywhere in sight. All the day's visitors have headed back down the washboard road in their expeditions and pathfinders. The woman, Alena, asks,
There is some place nearby I can camp, do you think?
He's been there himself, a long haul with no campsite ahead. He spreads his palms, all the abandoned buildings he's supposed to check and clear each night.
No camping allowed, but who's to know? Take your pick.
She bows her head.
Do you maybe have crackers or something?
It occurs to him that it may not be his storytelling skill that held her saucer-eyed, but he brings her up to the cabin and feeds her. Pulls out all the stops, the rabbit fillet he's been saving for no reason, fried mushrooms and onions, a decent coffee cake made of grape nuts, and a couple of shots of fermented thimbleberry. She tells him about her adventures walking across the Garnet Range.
We started out 4 people. No idea where those 3 went.
Kind of dangerous out this way. You shouldn't be out here by yourself, looking like you do.
How I look?
She blows a raspberry and whisks her palm.
Like an ill monkey who needs washing.
She looks to Douglas, good enough to be some mail-order bride scam.
Really? A young woman, by herself? Not a patentable idea.
Young? Who is that? Besides, this is the greatest country. Americans are the friendliest people in the world. Always want to help. Like you. Look, you made this great meal. You didn't need...
You liked it? Really?
She holds out her glass for more thimbleberry wine.
Well, he says, when the silence gets weird, even by his standards, you're welcome to the water from the pump. Take your pick of any building down there. I'd keep out of the barber shop. Something must have died in there recently.
This house is nice.
Oh, well, listen, you don't owe me anything. It was just food.
Who's making a business?
Then she's straddling his chair, scrutinizing his face, trying it out with her periscope lips. She breaks off.
Hey, you're crying. Strange man.
There's no good reason why any species would ever have evolved so useless a behavior.
I'm an old guy.
You're sure? Let's see.
She tries again, the first woman's flesh to warm his for years. It's like a lockpick scratching around a bunged-up keyhole in his chest. He pins her wrists.
I don't love you.
Okay, mister. No problem. I don't love you either.
She tugs at his chin.
People don't have to love to enjoy.
He gives her back her hands.
Trust me, they do.
His arms go slack, like they're chained through a pipe to a concrete slab buried in the ground.
Okay,
she says again, sullen. She pushes against his chest and stands.
You are a sad little mammal.
I am that.
He stands and brings the remains of the feast to the basin.
You take the bed. I'll sleep in the bag out here. The facilities are in the yard. Careful of the stinging nettle.
The sight of the bed thrills her. American Christmas.
You are a good old guy.
Not especially.
He shows her how to work the lantern. Lying on the floor in the front room, he sees the light under the door. Someone's reading late. He doesn't realize until later just what she's reading. In the morning, there's more grape-nut coffee cake and actual coffee. No further adventures in cross-cultural misunderstanding. She leaves before the first tourists come up the mountain. Soon enough, the visitor isn't even a story he tells himself at night to feed his regrets and beat up on himself for nostalgia. But America, it turns out, really is the greatest country. The people are so kind. The land is rich beyond imagining, and the authorities will cut a deal for useful information, even after booking you for multiple crimes. In 2 more months, when the men with the initials on their jackets make their way up the mountain, Douglas has all but forgotten his overnight guest. Not until the Freddies pin him in the driveway,
tear up the cabin and remove his handwritten journal in a sealed plastic box, does he remember her? He fights to keep from smiling as they hogtie him and get him into the government land cruiser.
You think this is funny?
No. No, of course not.
Well...